Okay, so yeah, thank you for the introduction. It's great to be back. Let me first mention my collaborators, Rachel Rosen, who's at Columbia, who many of you probably know because she was here as one of the Emmy Noether Fellows a few years ago, and Austin Joyce and James Bonifacio, who are both excellent postdocs. Austin's at Columbia, James is at Case Western, and some of you may know them as well because they were both visitors here at some point while I was here. So this is going to be mostly a talk about quantum field theory and S-matrix stuff, but it relates to cosmology, and in particular, it relates to any, if you have any sort of ideas for modifying gravity or for explaining the acceleration of the universe or that kind of thing, typically any of these models that you write down, for example, Galileans or massive gravity-like theories, they're all effective field theories. They all come with some usually extremely limited regime of validity, usually the maximum or the minimum distance, rather, over which you can trust them is a typical scale is something like thousands of kilometers. And if you want to find any sort of sharp signals for these things in highly dynamical situations, for example, colliding black holes, things that LIGO are going to observe, and you want to have any kind of robust prediction for what it's going to give that may be different from general relativity, you quickly run into the fact that these are effective field theories. You dynamically exit the regime of validity very quickly, and this manifests as breakdowns in the initial value formulation, your numerical simulations get stuck, things like this. So the principal theoretical problem facing all of these theories is that of UV completion. How can we extend these theories to a regime of validity that's more like the normal types of particle theories that we are familiar with, like the standard model? How can we go beyond these very low strong coupling scales? So that's what I'm going to be trying to get at with these field theory things that I'm going to be talking about. What kind of constraints or obstructions can we find against UV completion for certain classes of these theories, in particular ones that have massive higher spins, which are relevant for massive gravity-like theories?
Just a quick comment. This is April now, so it should be 1804 if you're...
Uh-oh, yep. So you... I already tell that it's been delayed, yeah.
It's never happened to anybody else.
Yeah. Okay, so the sharp question we're going to ask is the following. Is it possible to have a complete field theory with a particle spectrum that looks something like this, where we have some low mass particles here with mass little m that we'd like to be massive spinning particles? That's where we're going to get the sharpest constraints. So for example, a massive spin 2 or maybe a collection of massive higher spins and massless things, some finite number of light particles here, and then some parametrically large gap in the spectrum up to some next highest mass scale capital M.
So spin here means two or greater?
Generally, yes. Okay. I'll say the spins as we go. So the answer to this question for spin 0 and spin 1/2 is yes. We know examples like this. So for spin 0, you can have pseudo-Goldstone bosons, which are very light and protected by a large gap compared to other heavier stuff. And for spin 1/2, you can have pseudo-Goldstone fermions with if you have spontaneously broken supersymmetry. For spin 1 and for spin 3/2, the answer is also yes. For spin 1, you can have spontaneously broken weakly coupled gauge theories where you have light spin 1 particles that are light in comparison to wherever the Higgs comes in. And for spin 3/2, you can have spontaneously broken supergravity with the same kind of thing. For spin 2 and higher, the common lore says that the answer is no, that you can't have a massive higher spin with spin greater than or equal to 2 and also have this type of parametrically large gap.
Unless little m is 0.
Sorry?
Unless little m is 0 and spin is 2.
Why do you say that?
Because the graviton would satisfy that.
That's massless.
Yeah, so that would be the m equals 0 part.
Right, so I'm concerned with m not equal to 0. That's a big difference. Yeah. So yeah, I'll say... Yep, let me mention that. So some examples of this, examples of theories that have massive higher spins and that are consistent are things like Kaluza-Klein theory. So Kaluza-Klein theory is a theory where you have a tower of massive higher spins of spin all less than or equal to 2 in this case. And the masses of the higher spins, of the spin 2s in this case, are given by the values, the eigenvalues of the Laplacian on your internal manifold that you use for the Kaluza-Klein reduction. But in all the known cases, the eigenvalues are more or less equally spaced like this. We don't get this kind of parametric gap between the first lowest non-zero eigenvalue and the next non-zero eigenvalue. So this doesn't give us the kind of gap that we're asking for. The same is true of confining gauge theories. So you can think of a confining gauge theory like QCD as a theory of interacting massive higher spins. The hadrons and the gluons and mesons and so on, or the glue balls rather, and mesons of the theory are the massive higher spins, and they're interacting. They can be even weakly interacting if you have a large N theory. And in this case, again, you don't have this parametric gap. So the mass of the higher spins is set by the QCD scale, and you typically have this kind of even spacing. You don't have these parametric gaps between light massive particles and the more massive particles. Same with string theory. In string theory, you also have towers of higher spins, but the lightest massive higher spin is not separated from the more massive ones by a parametric gap. Yeah.
In principle, if you break spontaneously the gauge symmetry, such as SU3 plus SU2 plus U1,
yeah,
then you will get the low mass.
Well, that, for spin one.
But a spin two or higher? I don't know if
you wouldn't get
like that of spin two and higher. Lower spin, yes. Mm-hmm. He's already
the lowest spin is, that's right. But the lowest spins you can get with some mass, little m. But then a huge mass gap would be one of the
other. But when he means spin, he means two or higher.
Right. You don't get a K.
He's already conceded the spin one, spin half, you can get this gap.
Well, two or higher, you do get massive.
Sure.
Right, but you don't get a gap in that case. Yeah.
Going back in history.
Sorry, I still didn't get which gap is it that you are looking for? Does this not matter for string theory?
So I'm looking for a situation like this where we have a massive spin 2 or greater, followed
by small enough massive 2.
Yeah.
That's what you're looking.
That's right. That I don't know any examples of.
Small but non-zero.
Right. Yeah.
I'll let you go on to the talk in a minute. Going back in history, the Rita Schlegel particle spin 3.5 has conditions on it, otherwise you get ghosts. From all the higher spins, fermion spins, so if you interact through standard field theory, they all have ghosts. And you need constraints for every single spin.
Yep, I will.
Believing in standard field theory.
Yeah, I'm going to.
That's a problem.
Very, very good, yes.
Kurt, just to check.
Yeah.
By those masses, you want to insist upon just a single one. You don't want to lump multiple.
Well, a single or some finite small collection.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you want it to be interacting, I assume?
Yes.
And
that's right.
Why do you want it?
So I'll get to that. Okay, so there's several. So my motivation is this following one. Is it possible that the graviton could have a very small Hubble scale mass? So this, you know, is of interest for a long range modification of gravity. If the graviton has a very small mass, then the potential it's going to generate is some Yukawa potential, which falls off at a length scale set by the Compton wavelength, set by the mass. So if you imagine that the mass is very, very small of order the Hubble scale today, then you're going to be weakening gravity on distances of the horizon today. And that might say something about the acceleration of the universe. So this is a situation where you'd have a very light massive particle and then some huge gap up to the next lightest particle in the standard model, the neutrino. But this is a more general question in field theory. Is it possible to have particles with spin greater than or equal to 2 that are massive that you can say are elementary? In other words, their Compton wavelength is much larger than their intrinsic size. So that's even a question for QCD, for confining gauge theories. Is it possible to have hadrons or mesons with higher spin 2 or greater, that have a Compton wavelength much larger than their internal size that you can really think of as elementary particles in some sense instead of composites?
So you just repeat the problem with half integers. Here you're only talking about bosons.
Well, bosons or fermions, but there's this spin 2 barrier. So once you get spin 2 or higher, that's where you start. Free halves is okay. You can do that with supergravity.
I don't believe in supergravity. Okay.
he's asking me principal questions.
Yeah,
before.
These are theoretically. Yeah. Okay, so if such a situation exists, if you have some light massive particles followed by this large gap, this is exactly the situation in which you are able to write down a nice effective field theory. So if you have some collections of particles that you think should exist in a theory with such a gap, then it must be possible to write down an effective field theory for them with a cutoff that's parametrically larger than the mass, some lambda cutoff that's much larger than the masses of these particles. So if you have some hypothesized collection of light particles, if the effective field theory doesn't exist, you've solved the problem. There's no such theory. However, if the effective field theory does exist, you then have to go further. You have to ask whether that effective field theory can be UV completed in some normal way. So that's going to be our approach. Look for such effective field theories and then try to find obstructions to their UV completion.
Currently, the first possibility is the line of reasoning so tight that you're going to be able to conclude, yeah, the problem was not the EFT mechanism that I was trying to work out as opposed to this principle?
So the answer seems to be no, that any set of particles that you can think of, you can usually write down. I don't know any examples where you can't write down an effective field theory that has a parametrically higher cutoff.
Well, but one thing is to not know, the other one is to be certain.
That's right, yeah. So it's the former. Just by example, we don't know, but I can't say for certain that it's impossible.
But it is a theorem about massless cases.
Oh, yeah, massless is different,
massless,
yeah.
It is a theorem that you can have
here.
So, massive.
There's a KKA example where you have to know something about the hybrid. If you integrate, you take a mass of fermions and try to integrate them out, you cannot know whether there are KK bubbles or nothing or not. So you can occasionally need to know more about EFT than you would have thought.
Oh, sure, yeah, that would go under the obstructions to the UV completion. Yeah.
But the relevance of that, so the massless case, you know, if your effective field theory existed for some small mass, it's probably going to exist for a range of masses, and then that would include zero. So the absence of a massless higher than 2 spin case probably suggests that the spin 2 is going to be really different from higher than 2, right?
Indeed, yes, yes. Yep. So let's start with the spin 2 case. This is, so those of you who were here when I was here have heard me talk about this a bunch. So massive spin 2 particle is this borderline case where we know that a massless theory, interacting theory exists, general relativity. For a massive spin 2 particle, we know that it has more degrees of freedom. So it's not really, the massless limit isn't really continuous. You can't generally conclude things about a massless theory just by knowing the massive one because there's a discontinuity in the number of degrees of freedom. The massive spin 2 has 5 degrees of freedom. Here is the action for the free theory, the Fierz-Pauli action. So h mu nu is the symmetric tensor that carries the massive spin 2. And the kinetic part is just what you would get by linearizing Einstein-Hilbert general relativity. This part has a gauge symmetry, which is just the linearization of diffeomorphism symmetry of general relativity. And then there's a mass term which breaks this gauge invariance, and it has a particular tuned structure here. These two different possible contractions of the tensor h mu nu have to have the proper relative coefficient of -1 in order to ensure that there's exactly 5 degrees of freedom and not more. And one way to see that there's exactly the right number of degrees of freedom is through the equations of motion. You can cast them into a Klein-Gordon equation for the 10 components of the symmetric tensor, but then there are 5 constraint equations as well that take you down to the 5 degrees of freedom that you need. In terms of the various helicity components, if you look at high energies of a massive spin 2, the 5 degrees of freedom break up into 2 helicity plus and minus 2 degrees of freedom, 2 helicity plus and minus 1 degrees of freedom, and a helicity 0 degree of freedom. So at the level of fields, you can introduce a new field a mu to carry the helicity 1 and a field phi to carry the helicity 0. you can take this high energy limit directly in the Lagrangian, and everything breaks up as you'd expect. You get a massless Lagrangian for the helicity 2 parts, you get a Maxwell-like Lagrangian for the helicity 1, and you get a free scalar field Lagrangian for the helicity 0. If we now start to ask about the interaction terms in order to build an effective field theory, we should be a good effective field theorist and write everything that's possible. So I'm going to start by making the interactions of the two derivative part of the interactions to look like Einstein-Hilbert. We're going to relax this later, because in fact, there's no reason to say that the kinetic structure should be of Einstein-Hilbert form, since we don't have the diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity anyway. But for now, as an illustration, let's take it. And then for the zero derivative part, we're just going to write down every possibility. So here, these brackets here are just all possible tensor structures that you can construct out of the field H. And at second order, we have this relative minus 1 tuning that I mentioned in the kinetic part. But then for the cubic and higher terms, we've just written every possibility with an arbitrary coefficient. And then if you look at what the effective field theory looks like, so you introduce the fields for the helicity 1 and helicity 0 modes, and you plug it in, and you get a whole slew of various derivative interaction terms, which are non-renormalizable terms. And these non-renormalizable terms all come with a particular scale. And to ask what the strong coupling scale of the theory is, you have to look at the lowest such scale that appears among these terms. And the lowest such scale that appears is this scale lambda 5, which is this fifth root geometric mean between the Planck mass m Planck and little m, which is the mass of the spin 2. And the term which carries this scale is self-interactions of the longitudinal mode, of the scalar mode. So this is the UV strong coupling scale of the theory. So this is the picture we have. Here's little m, the mass of the spin 2. Here's the Planck mass way up here. And we have this intermediate scale, lambda 5, where we have strong, where the effective field theory of this particular massive spin 2 breaks down. So we've succeeded with no effort in writing down an effective field theory which has a strong coupling scale here, lambda 5, that's parametrically larger than the mass m, but we haven't done as well as GR yet.
Standard field theory, what about all the ghosts in interaction?
So I'll get to that, but in general, we don't care about ghosts in an effective field theory unless their mass scale is below the cutoff. So in this theory, in fact, around flat space, you don't even have to worry about the ghost because its mass is above the cutoff. And that's quite generally true of effective field theories. If you get the kinetic structure right and you have the right number of degrees of freedom there, then you add interactions, the scale at which you introduce ghosts is generally higher than the cutoff.
Breaks down above.
Right. So then you're back to the issue of UV completion.
Don't worry about that.
This operator becomes, this one becomes relevant in low energy, is that what you're saying?
Well, it's an irrelevant operator, so it becomes important at high energies, which for this theory is this lambda 5.
So the strong coupling is the UV.
Right, that's right.
One other point, getting back to experimental physics. From the neutron star merger, we now know that gravitational waves move speed of light to 1/10^15. So that's going to put a severe constraint on your mass spin 2.
Yeah, that's going to constrain theories where you have a different propagation speed between tensor modes and scalar modes. But that actually doesn't constrain these massive gravity theories very much, because they have a kinetic structure which is the same as Einstein-Hilbert. They propagate their tensor modes at the speed of gravity, as long as the mass is small.
Small?
Yeah.
How small?
Well, if we're thinking of a Hubble scale mass, then that's it. Yeah.
Okay. Question.
Yeah.
In expanding the theory, you're expanding with the bounded flat.
Yes. Like that. That's right.
Now, if you would allow expansion around curved boundaries, then you can have the kind of interacting higher spin fields.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's a whole other story.
So
yeah.
If you follow that route,
yes.
So maybe that you allow, since there are interactions, you start from a theory that has the kinds of interactions you have, mm-hmm. and then search for what is possible.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. And in fact, in ADS, it's possible. I know examples where you can get this kind of gap. But that's a different story, yeah.
So you're not concerned?
Right, I'm on flat space for today. Yeah.
So you said it's a different, so you're not going to talk about that?
No.
Okay, but then answer one question. So you say there is an effective theory in ADS where you arrange that, can you do a next step in that example? Can you see this, you know, because you can write down ADS phenomenology or you can think about some top-down construction.
Uh-huh.
So is that saying something that you can write down the top-down string models that gives you ADS?
So I don't know about a string model, but at least, well, let me talk to you afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, let me not get distracted by that. Let me talk.
Can you say yes or no?
You can write down a model which has a which I would call a UV extension of the massive spin 2, which would take you to scales to the Planck mass.
Is it n-dimensional supergravity? Yes or no?
4-dimensional.
Okay, then the answer is no.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
One more question since you've been distracted.
Yeah.
If you go back to the relationship between lambda and little m, is the logic behind that when you wrote down all these v1, v2, v3s, and is there a little m squared in front of that whole thing? And
yes.
That's how you're identifying when the m's
going? Yeah, that's like a choice of power counting to start with. Okay, so if we look at what's happening in this effective field theory, if we look at the two particle, the 2-to-2 amplitude, so just graviton scattering, the simplest non-trivial process in this theory, the amplitude grows with energy like the 10th power of energy. It grows very fast with energy. If you look at the polarization tensors of the massive spin 2, so you have transverse polarization tensors, which carry the helicity 2 modes roughly, and at high energies they are of order 1. The vector polarizations at high energies are of order E, and the scalar polarizations are of order E squared. The propagator also grows badly with energy, at least in a unitary gauge. And so when you count up all the powers of how this diagram is growing, it grows up like the 10 powers of the energy. That's in the language of the original tensor field. In the language of this Stokelberg field, or the longitudinal mode, these high numbers of derivatives in the interaction term are responsible for giving the energy growing like e to the 10th. So these are these self-interactions of the scalar field that are responsible for the worst behavior. Okay, so an insight that was made almost 15 years ago now is that you can choose these interactions order by order in powers of the field so that these scalar self-interactions, these things responsible for the leading strong coupling behavior, disappear into total derivative combinations. And it turns out that there's a two-parameter family of ways to do this. And once you do this, the leading operators are now these things, which have some powers of the scalar and one power of the helicity 2. And the strong coupling scale is raised to this power lambda 3, which is still parametrically lower than the Planck mass, but now much higher than lambda 5. Here's what the leading operators in that theory look like. So there are two parameter family of ways to do this. These are the two parameters called D5 and C3. And these X's that are the terms carrying the scalar come in a particular combination such that the equations of motion don't have any higher derivatives. So these are known as the Galilean operators. This is a Galilean theory. And if you look at the 2-to-2 amplitudes in this theory, the amplitudes now grow like energy to the sixth. So they grow. They have, in some sense, softer behavior in the UV. And they work because of a cancellation now between the exchange diagrams and the contact diagram that cancels off the leading e to the 10th and subleading e to the 8th behavior that we had in the generic case. So from the level, for looking at this in terms of the Galilean Lagrangian, you have now fewer powers of derivatives per field. And so you get this better behaved e to the 6th behavior.
Can I ask one more question before you get too far into this?
Yeah.
So if you think about lower spins, how it works, you know, the thing you're doing now wouldn't have been what you would have done. Because
right.
What would have happened is that once you got to the scale where you wrote the symmetry, you would have found linear realizations of the symmetries with more fields involved.
Exactly, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So if you had that kind of approach here and you said, I just take some field that's going to break, you know, different morphine aberrants, and,
yeah,
and I give it a fab,
yeah,
and I look at what it looks like at low energies. Can you kind of get this thing? What goes wrong with that construction?
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be possible. I'll say something about that later. That doesn't seem to be possible. But this particular cancellation mechanism has no analog in the lower spin case. So you can resum this theory with the choice of this two-parameter choice of ways of raising the cutoff like this. And the resummation looks rather simple. And it's simplest if you write it in terms of Fielbein variables. The mass terms now just take the point of, they look like just all possible wedge products of the dynamical Fielbein, here called E, and 1, which is the Fielbein of the background Minkowski metric around which you built the theory. So you can think of this as bimetric generalizations of the cosmological constant, if you like.
You said that we don't have to worry about ghosts.
Yeah, this theory also happens to be ghost-free. That comes for free once you raise the cutoff.
Independent of the cutoff.
It comes for free once you raise the cutoff in this language. Okay, it turns out there's another way to do this, another way to achieve this e to the sixth behavior, this so-called pseudo-linear theory of massive gravity, where you don't start with the Einstein-Hilbert term, you just start with the linearized kinetic term, and then you try to add interaction terms on top of this. And this is a kind of a linearized version of this ghost-free massive gravity, or the DRGT theory. And it also has two parameters. And it also achieves this e to the sixth better behaved UV behavior. Okay, so the general question we'd like to ask, is there any way to do better? Can we arrange interaction?
Sorry, can you go back? Are you saying you're changing the GR part or not?
Right.
Changing the GR part.
Right, so there's no GR-like interaction terms with two derivatives here. There's no Einstein-Hilbert structure.
The derivative is still GR.
That's right. The linear part is still GR. Okay. So we want to ask in complete generality, is there a way to do better than this e to the sixth behavior in the UV, or can you, by adding arbitrary kinetic terms with arbitrary numbers of derivatives, can we make the cancellation work even better? So what we want to do is go back to our effective field theory and now allow any possibility of any number of derivatives in the interaction terms. So to answer this, we can't just write down every possible term with arbitrary numbers of derivatives. We have to go to an S matrix approach and look on shell and do some more clever things. So the first thing you can do if you're looking only at the S matrix is to put everything on shell. By doing field redefinitions, we can order by order put everything, put this tensor field on shell, so make it satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation, make it transverse and traceless. And then we want to, if we're going to look just at the 2 to 2 amplitude, we need all the cubic vertices and all the quartic vertices. So we need to classify all the possible on-shell cubic vertices that can appear and all the possible on-shell quartic vertices that can appear. Yes?
I have maybe a silly question. So in your case, the coefficients of this del square and del force are going to be of order 1, right? Or in principle.
So
where I'm heading is, how do I set up? Suppose I don't want to do quantum. I take this effective field theory and I just want to study it classically. So I have a theory with, you know, higher derivatives. I wouldn't know what to do with that. I have problems with that. So is this something?
Well, yeah. I mean, a sharp question we're asking is about the tree level S matrix. So that's classical. We're asking a tree level process of the S matrix. And the invariant question to ask, the thing that doesn't depend on what order the coefficients are, is how the thing behaves at high energy.
But in general, I know that, say, in supergravities, or when I include high derivative correction, I can only deal with them if they are, you know, infinitesimal. Coefficients of high derivative. I cannot, honestly, I wouldn't even know how to set up a Cauchy problem.
But we don't have to, when we're just talking about the on-shell S matrix, we don't have to worry about any of that.
So in some sense, this is, right, so you are not at, maybe what I'm asking was whether or not you are planning to do non-linear, you know.
Well, eventually, but that's the next question. So if you want to,
That's why you answered me, that it's a tree level.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, this has to work in order to get in a consistent theory before you can even worry about these things. Okay, so we'll start with the cubic vertices. So a convenient way to classify them is to take the polarization tensors that appear for, so now we're imagining generalizing going to some spin S particle. So there's some polarization tensor with S indices that has the properties of being transverse and traceless. And it's convenient to represent them with some auxiliary variable Z, some product of these Zs, where Z squared equals zero encodes the fact that this thing is traceless. And so we can construct our amplitudes out of these z's and then at the end of the day replace them back with the polarization vector. When we're talking about cubic vertices that are on-shell, there are no on-shell non-trivial functions of the momenta when we have only three particles. So momentum conservation tells us that all the possible dot products between any two of the momenta can always be written solely in terms of the masses. So there's no Mandelstam invariance at 3 points. So our general amplitude is completely nailed down. It can only take a form that looks like this. So here, Z12 means the dot product between two of these Zs for the first and second particle, first and third particle, and so on. And then Zp means a dot product between Z of the first particle and the momentum of the second particle, and so on. And so it has to be of this polynomial form. And then there have to be the right number of z's appearing so that you can recombine it into the polarization vector of the particular spin. So there's a constraint here on these exponents that it has to sum up to the right spins. So you're writing down this general polynomial subject to these constraints, and you have to solve it in integers. And there's a finite number of solutions for any given choice of spins. So that means that the on-shell cubic amplitudes are completely nailed down just by Lorentz invariance and the choice of spins. There's a finite number of them. And so classifying them is a finite task. So now when we construct the exchange amplitudes out of these three-point functions, we build the S, T, and U channel, and we sum them up. And because there are a finite number of vertices, they can only grow with some ultimate power of energy. There's some bounded growth with energy. So these exchange diagrams grow with some number of powers of the energy. We now have to find the contact diagram. So we need, for this, the four particle amplitudes. So we can classify all the analytic quartic amplitudes, and again, you get some equation like this, but now there's not a finite number anymore because you have Mandelstam invariance. You can have arbitrary products of these two momenta, which are nothing but the Mandelstam invariance, and the rest of the products are all constrained by having the right number of spins. So what you have at the end of the day is some finite number of tensor structures, which can be multiplied by arbitrary functions of Mandelstam invariance. And that gives you the general contact diagram. So now to achieve this best possible scaling, we're going to try to arrange for there to be a cancellation among the high energy behavior between the quartic and the exchange diagrams. So the exchange ones grew with some power of the momentum. We're now going to try to choose the quartic amplitude here, such as to cancel the worst growing powers of energy from the exchange diagram and try to work our way down as far as we can without killing the entire amplitude. So the result of this in the spin 2 case is that, in fact, the best possible scaling you can achieve is this e to the 6th. So the DRGT massive gravity and the pseudolinear theory that I showed are the only two possible theories that achieve this best possible scaling. So this is another way of isolating these as interesting effective field theories by asking for the best possible tree-level two-particle scattering. We can repeat this exercise for other spins. So if you do this for spin 1, if you have just a single spin 1, the best possible scaling you can achieve is e to the 4th, which corresponds to a lambda 2-like cutoff. But now we can do what Cliff was mentioning and ask to allow for some additional new particles that might be coming in from some linear realization of the symmetry or so on. So we can allow for an additional massive scalar, for instance. And now once you add this additional massive scalar, you find that you can in fact achieve no growth at all at high energies, which means you've UV completed the theory and you can rediscover the Higgs mechanism using this.
So you couldn't have done this for spin 2?
So for spin 2, the scaling the best possible scaling we had was e to the 6. We can now ask the same question. Can you put in new lower spin degrees of freedom in the hopes of UV completing it by some kind of Higgs mechanism? So we can allow for an additional scalar and a vector. And we find that it's impossible to get even beyond this e to the 6. So there's no direct analog of a gravitational Higgs mechanism that can UV complete a massive spin 2.
I could say implicit assumption here would be a finite number of degrees of freedom.
Yes.
So
absolutely. Yeah.
But also, is it true that what's killing this linear realization story is that any field I would have put in that would give the graviton a mass is also going to break Lorentz invariance or something? So you're requiring everything.
We're assuming Lorentz invariance. So if you're willing to break Lorentz invariance, then something like a ghost condensate, maybe you even think is.
So that's the no go.
Sorry.
Grounds will also break Lorentz invariance.
Yeah, if you have some non-trivial.
You know it is possible.
That's right.
Non-zero fair, the vector two will break Lorentz invariance.
That's right. Yeah.
Could you have imagined there being a world where you do break Lorentz invariance, but only at the Hubble scale, so that you wouldn't have known it, and you could get away with the mass?
Yep, and indeed, that's a possible way out. Okay. So we've also repeated this for some of the higher spins, and we have a conjecture that this is the best possible scaling you can have for the higher spins, which corresponds to this kind of cutoff. So as you raise the spin, this maximal possible cutoff goes down. We can ask the same question for other cases. For example, massive higher spins coupled to gauge fields. This was actually a case considered a while ago by Massimo Parati and Rakabur Raman. They found a universal highest possible cutoff for a massive linear higher spin. So now you imagine there's no self-interactions among the higher spin, but you couple it nonlinearly to electromagnetism, to some massless U1, and you find a maximal possible cutoff that looks like this. So little m is the mass of the higher spin, and E is now the electric charge, the coupling to U1. We've also repeated this for the case of a massive higher spin coupled to gravity, and you get this kind of a relation. Again, a maximal possible cutoff that goes down with the spin. And in fact, it lines up if you assume that for some reason the weak gravity conjecture is saturated, then these cutoffs correspond to each other. Okay, so this is more or less the best we can do as far as constructing effective field theories that are the best behaved. We now want to ask questions about what possible UV constraints you can put on them, what kind of obstructions there might be to UV completion. So there's two general classes of constraints that I want to talk about. The first is from dispersion relations. The second is from superluminality. And these are both purely S-matrix constraints, purely on-shell things that don't require knowing about background solutions or anything like that. So the first is these dispersion relations. And the main idea here is to look at the two-particle S-matrix and to look in a particular limit where you're looking at the forward scattering. So as a function of the Mandelstams, you're looking where t equals 0, and you're looking at the amplitude as a complex function of the center of mass energy, of s. And the analytic structure of the two-particle amplitude in this case is expected to look something like this. So we have poles here at m squared, which corresponds to the tree-level exchange of the massive particle. There's a mirror image pole here at 3m squared, which corresponds to the T-channel exchange. And then there's a branch cut here starting at 4m squared, which is where you start to get particle production from loops that include the light particle. And then there's a mirror here, a branch cut that corresponds to the T-channel. So this is the general complex structure that we're working with. We want to consider this quantity, which we call f, which is a contour integral along this contour of this amplitude divided by s minus mu squared to some power. So n here is some power that we're going to choose later to be convenient. Mu is some arbitrary point at which where you can think of as where we're sampling the amplitude. This quantity f has two parts to the contour. There's the part that circles these branch cuts, and then there's the semicircles at infinity. We can kill the semicircles at infinity by invoking the so-called Frassart bound, which puts a limit on the growth of the amplitude in a UV complete theory of massive particles. So here we're now considering the amplitude not in the effective field theory, but in some putative UV completion.
And you're also assuming no weirder non-analyticities.
That's right, we're assuming the analyticity of the S matrix.
Way back in history, there was a time when quantum field theory was in rather disgrace. And what reigned was the S matrix theory of the Rankine poles in the equivalent plane. All of this dispersion stuff. It's only when you start doing field theory that you go into trouble, so to speak. So why did we do that now?
Well, this is, I'm only doing field theory here. This is all standard field theories stuff.
And in reciprocal theory, there's a contagion, infinite number of particles, all spins of the regular trajectories. And that's what led to string theory.
Okay, so you can show that this semicircle vanishes. And then what's left is...
Can I ask you something? So isn't it true that Frassart bound is actually violative for gravity?
So for massless particles, yeah, it's more subtle. For massive particles, it's a sharper statement.
So what is the sharpest? Because, I mean, we are dealing with, ultimately we're interested in the theory of gravity, right?
Yeah.
And isn't the problem that basically at high energy you start making black holes?
Right.
And this becomes much bigger basically. Okay.
Right, but for massive particles, it's supposed to be a sharp conclusion of these people who do rigorous field theory.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But yeah, for massless particles it's not. Okay, so the contours we have are these things that go around the branch cuts. So that gives you the discontinuity of the amplitude across the branch cut. That discontinuity can be related via the optical theorem to the cross section, which must be positive. The integrand, if this exponent n is even, is also positive. So we find that this quantity f has to be positive. You can then deform the contour and write it instead as a thing that surrounds these poles that we had, the exchange poles at m, and the pole that we have from sampling here at mu squared. These exchange poles are coming from only these two particles exchange within the effective field theory. So these can be calculated at tree level within the effective field theory, just calculating the residue of these poles. In fact, you can deform then the contour within the effective field theory back out to infinity and rewrite this quantity f in terms of coefficients of this leading energy behavior in the effective field theory. So when you do this, you get constraints on the theory, on the effective field theory, that have to be satisfied in order to have a normal UV completion that satisfies analyticity of the S matrix and the Lorentz invariance and the usual assumptions. So here's the island that you get of allowed points. So this was done by Cliff Chung and Grant Remen a few years ago. Here are the two parameters in the two parameter family of ways of raising the cutoff to have this e to the sixth better behavior. This is the DRGT theory. And within this two parameter family, you have this little region here that's allowed, this quantity f is positive, and you don't have any obstruction, at least at this order, against UV completion.
What do the colors mean?
The colors were various polarization states that they used to sample to get.
So is this conclusion robust if I just sprinkle some other particles in the effective field theory and allows them to couple to your massive?
That I have no idea.
So it's purely within an effective field series that contains just that massive.
That's right. This is just a massive spin 2.
And no interactions with the massless spin 2?
No other particles at all. That's right. So once you have massless particles in the theory, it becomes these dispersion relations no longer are really sharp.
Because your effective field theory does contain interactions with the masses.
Well, here I'm just imagining a pure massive spin too, no massless particle.
Okay, so it would not apply to the theory you really want.
Well, maybe this is the theory. If we think the graviton is massive, then this is the theory we really want.
That's fine.
There is no massless graviton. It would be just the graviton would be massive.
It would be empty you want.
Yeah, then you'd, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering, isn't the logic a little bit circular? Because you're saying that you assume Lorentz invariance, but you assume mass is comparable to Hubble. But then we know that we don't have Lorentz invariance on the scale of Hubble.
Yeah, indeed. That's a loophole here. That's okay. A loophole. So if you think that the S matrix isn't even valid because once you get to Hubble scale, you're not in Minkowski space anymore, then so yeah, indeed. What you'd like to do is generalize this to a de Sitter space. So we've repeated this also for the pseudo-linear theory, and in that case, you find that it's not allowed. There's no possible allowed region. So you have to have the Einstein-Hilbert-like interactions to have an allowed region. So the second constraint I want to talk about is from what you could call superluminality. So this is another traditional constraint that you put on effective field theories. You have some effective field theory. The Rabita-Schwinger-type constraints were of this form back in the day, the Velo-Zwanziger problem. And typically what you would do is find some non-trivial background solution for the effective field theory and then look for small fluctuations around it and demand that those small fluctuations propagate subluminally. And these kinds of constraints are always murky in the sense that you always get into arguments about whether the background you found was really within the regime of validity of the effective field theory or whether it could be dynamically reached from some nice initial data and so on. What we'd like to have is some S matrix constraint that's sharp that doesn't require some non-trivial backgrounds. And that's what was provided by this paper by these people, where they found basically showed how to find superluminality directly within the S matrix. And the idea is to consider iconal scattering. So you have, again, 2-to-2 scattering, but you imagine it in some limit in which you have very, very high energies, but some fixed impact parameter. So in terms of Mandelstam variables, S is going to infinity with T being held fixed. And intuitively, what's going on is that you have your first particle going very fast, say, towards the left, and your second particle going very fast towards the right. And you can think of this second particle as setting up a kind of shock wave through which this first particle propagates. And as the first particle propagates through the shock wave, it in general can get a time delay. The particle will come out later than it would have if there were no interaction. And the constraint you'd like to impose is that that time delay be positive, that it doesn't come out sooner than it would have if there were no interaction. So this is essentially the Shapiro delay in general relativity, that if you send some signal through a non-trivial gravitational background, it comes out later than you'd expect. And the constraint you want to impose is that it doesn't come out earlier than you'd expect. So you set up all the kinematics. And the statement is that in the iconal limit, the S matrix can be resummed. And the only diagrams that contribute are these loop diagrams that look like ladders and all crossed ladders. And these diagrams are all finite in the iconal limit, and they sum into this exponential form, which is the exponential of just the T-channel exchange at tree level. So at the end of the day, you get this phase, delta, the so-called iconal phase, which can be calculated solely from the T-channel exchange at tree level. And the time delay is directly proportional to this iconal phase. So you want the iconal phase to be positive. Furthermore, you can show that the iconal phase depends only on the on-shell three-point amplitudes of the theory, the things that were finite in number and that we could classify. And I won't have time to explain why this is the case, but it is the case. It depends only on the tree level, it depends only on the on-shell three-point functions. So here's an example of the kind of thing that we can constrain using this iconal phase that was showed already in this paper. So imagine we have a theory which is general relativity plus some higher derivative curvature correction, some r squared term, say, which are suppressed by some scale m here, which is much less than the Planck mass. So these are higher derivative terms which are much larger than you'd naively expect just from quantum gravity corrections. So if these terms are, let's say that the only terms that are here are these R squared terms, that there's no higher powers of R. In that case, we can expand out and look at what the effective field theory strong coupling scale is, and you'd find this scale here, lambda, which is kind of like a lambda 3 scale in massive gravity, which is this geometric mean. So again, parametrically higher than the mass scale m that appears here, but lower than the Planck mass. So you'd expect this as an effective field theory to be valid all the way up to this strong coupling scale, lambda. In string theory, you do get these types of corrections, these R squared types of corrections, but you also get R cubed and R to the fourth and so on. And so when you start considering these higher order corrections and look at what the naive strong coupling scale would be, it starts getting driven down all the way to M, which is what you expect, because new string states are coming in at the scale M. So we're imagining that it's not this, that it's something like this where the terms stop at R squared, and we think we have an effective field theory valid up to the scale lambda. So now we go and we classify the cubic vertices that are possible in a theory of a massless spin 2, and we find that there's only three possible cubic vertices. There's one that comes from the cubic part of the Einstein-Hilbert term, there's one that comes from the cubic part of Gauss-Bonnet term, and there's one that comes from the cubic part of Riemann cube term. These are the only possibilities on shell. In four dimensions, this guy happens to vanish, and then there's some additional parity violating ones.
So, sorry, but you only have quadratic ones. You have a cubic of curvature as well.
Yeah. So now I'm classifying the possible on-shell amplitude. So I'm imagining the theory doesn't actually have this vertex, but it's a possible vertex, but
okay.
We're imagining doesn't have it.
Does this apply to derivatives of Riemann 2?
Yeah, this is all possible things you could possibly write down. The statement is that at cubic order on shell, you can get it to look like one of these.
Okay.
So now we calculate this iconal phase. And so the phase is actually a matrix because you have different helicity configurations that you can consider, and you'd like the eigenvalues to all be positive. So from the Einstein-Hilbert part, you get that it is always positive. So in pure Einstein gravity, you never have a time advance. It's always a time delay. But once you include the Gauss-Bonnet part, if you look at impact parameters that are what you'd think to be within the regime of validity of this effective field theory, you can find that the eigenvalues can be made negative by choosing appropriate helicities. So the statement that is that if you have an effective field theory like this, either the cubic that particular cubic term must vanish, or new particles must come in at the scale m, which is much lower than the naive cutoff that you thought. We can repeat the same thing for massless higher spins. So for massless spin 1, for example, there are two possible cubic vertices. There's the Yang-Mills cubic vertex, and then there's one that comes from field strength cubed. Here are the ones from gravity again. So gravity famously is Yang-Mills squared, and the Riemann cubed is field strength cubed squared, and then Yang-Mills times field strength cubed is Gauss-Bonnet. In four dimensions, that one happens to vanish. The same pattern appears for the higher spins. So spin S, the lowest derivative vertex is Yang-Mills to the S, and then derivatives increase all the way to field strength to the S, and all the intermediate ones are analogs of Gauss-Bonnet, they vanish in four dimensions. So we get two possible cubic vertices for any spin. This lowest derivative vertex is what would be the interesting one. It's the one that actually deforms the gauge symmetry and can give you non-trivial interesting interacting theories. The F cubed vertex does not deform the gauge symmetry. That just corresponds to linear field strengths raised to some power. If you ask for consistency of the theory at quartic order, consistency with respect to gauge invariance, so you want to add quartic terms to the theory which maintain the gauge symmetry, these are not allowed at, you're not allowed to have these vertices for spin 3 and greater. They fail the so-called four-particle test. But you are allowed to have these F cubed vertices. Those are perfectly consistent, at least from the point of view of gauge symmetry. However, these iconal constraints, it goes the other way. The low derivative vertices are consistent with subluminal propagation. The higher derivative vertices are ruled out. So this this is kind of exactly a complementary set of constraints to the usual constraints of consistent gauge interactions. So we've repeated this for the massive case now. So for a massive spin 2, there are now new allowed cubic vertices that you wouldn't have in the massless case. So there are two new, because you no longer have to have consistency with gauge symmetry. So there's now an H cubed vertex that's allowed, and there's this two derivative vertex, which is not of Einstein-Hilbert form, which is allowed. And so we can repeat this calculation of the iconal phase. So now the iconal phase matrix is some 5x5 matrix, because we have 5 different polarization states for the spin 2. So we are completely general. We allow the cubic vertex to be a linear combination of any 5 of the possible cubic vertices. So these alphas label the 5 cubic vertices going from H cubed up into to derivatives all the way to Riemann cubed. And then when we look at the iconal phase and we diagonalize it order by order in powers of the impact parameter, at lowest order we find the constraint that the Riemann cubed has to vanish. At next lowest order, again, the eigenvalues come in opposite signs. So in order not to have a superluminal phase shift, this pseudo-linear-like term has to vanish. Then when we get down here, all that's left now is Einstein-Hilbert plus the H-cubed vertex. And at this order, we find that they have to come in a particular combination. The Einstein-Hilbert and the H-cubed vertex have to be related to each other. And then once this is satisfied, everything is positive. So the end result is that we get that the allowed cubic vertex for a single massive spin 2 has to be of this form, Einstein-Hilbert plus this H-cubed vertex in this particular combination. And if it's not of this form, it means that new physics has to come in at the scale m of the graviton mass. You can't have this gap that we asked for at the very beginning. I'll skip this, but here's the end result on this picture that I showed earlier. So here was this funny shaped region that was allowed by the dispersion relations on the two parameters of the massive gravity theory. And here's now the new constraint that we get from iconal scattering that says that the cubic vertex has to be of this form. So this carves a line through the two parameter family, and that line intersects with the allowed region from the dispersion relations. So the statement is we can't completely rule out the possibility of an isolated massive spin 2, but if it exists and is to be UV completed in a normal fashion, it has to lie somewhere within this line here. So in conclusion, these iconal scattering and dispersion relations, they can provide useful model independent constraints on massive theories and massive gravity type theories in particular. The iconal scattering constraints in particular are nice because they only constrain this cubic vertex. So they're very model independent. You don't have to know anything about the rest of the nonlinear structure of the theory to say something. These isolated mass two, spin two, we can't completely rule it out. What we'd like to do is go beyond these leading order things. We would like to extend, for example, the iconal approximation to go beyond just this leading order in the iconal limit. Maybe some sub-leading parts of the iconal expansion would tell us stuff beyond just the cubic vertices, would start to tell us about the 4 particle vertices and so on. And we could imagine this forming a basis of a kind of bootstrap to carve out interacting theories of massive higher spin particles. So in particular, large N QCD is an example of this. So this could be part of a bootstrap for large N QCD. So out of time, I'll stop there.
Thank you. Questions? So Kent will be here. You'll be here tomorrow?
I'll be here tomorrow, the rest of today and tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning. So we're going to have lunch, of course, now, and then dinner with Kent at 6 p.m. in the bistro. Alex?
Quick question. So this Eigenmodel constraints, so again, you need a scattering state. So
yes,
they are not applicable to anything else as an Minkowski.
Yeah, so there have been some papers. Melbussain has written some things about applying them on ADS as well.
Okay. Yeah.
So
for the first constraint, for S matrix, Like you got an island for the DRGT, and then the second one had an overlap, or it looks like you didn't have DRGT.
Yeah, there was overlap. So let me get back here.
Okay, so that line is the only left.
Yeah, this little part here.
I see. Okay, that's fine.
So you alluded to this anti-de-Sitter thing that was different from what you're doing.
Yeah.
Somehow, if there's an anti-de-Sitter thing that works, you should be able to deform it to get a flat thing in some limit.
Yeah. Well, the problem is the mass of the spin 2 in the ADS case is proportional to the ADS scale, so it just goes to zero. It becomes massless in the flat limit.
John?
Back to experimental physics. There are two experiments we know about constraints and all this. One is, Lambda-CDM, the whole standard cosmology. Lambda works very well. W equals to minus one, which is quite well checked by Planck. So, we should probably need a dark energy theory of that. Okay. Another thing is the gravitational waves. LIGO. How do these 5 degrees of polarization affect that?
Yeah, that's what we'd like to know. And that's precisely the situation where you need a more complete theory. You need to be able to go beyond this cutoff of 1,000 kilometers or lambda three, because you need, if you're talking about compact systems that are highly dynamical, you very quickly evolve into regimes that are beyond the scale, and you need UV completion. You need a more complete thing to start to answer these things robustly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's precisely the motivation for all this.
Yeah. Binary pulses only see quadrupole radiation, no dipole, no
monopole.
Mm-hmm. To high degree of accuracy.
Right. So whatever new degrees of freedom are there have to be hidden. Screening. Yeah.
So your premise in all of this is that the gravitational physics has its origin in quantum field theory.
Yes.
But we have no evidence of that.
Well, we think gravity is a... We think everything's a quantum field theory.
But there's no evidence of that at this point.
There's no direct evidence that gravity is quantum mechanical, yes, I'd say.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure it's true. I can't absolutely swear, but I'm pretty sure it's true that in nonlinear NGR, I can arrange a time advance. Would you just utterly dispute that, or you would say, if that's true, I'm wondering about what I should make of the Yurei-Kolmogorov constraints.
So in ordinary GR, you can arrange a time advance?
At the nonlinear level, I'm pretty sure I can arrange
in an SM.
Regions that locally look like they're negative energy, and you can't do it globally.
With an asymptotically flat space?
I'm pretty sure, yes. I can't absolutely swear, but I'm pretty sure you could.
Then I'd be surprised if that were the case.
Okay, if that were true, would you have some responses to whether the Yurei-Kolmogorov constraints would make sense at that point?
I would doubt GR.
Okay. Yeah, but I guess your point is because coordinates, I mean, coordinate time, I mean, in terms of coordinates,
no.
You could go faster or slower than.
No. So I'm saying I'm pretty sure it's true. That I can locally arrange regions that look like they have negative energy in them,
uh-huh.
And I'll be able to get things where light would be able to go, light or gravity would go faster than you would think it could. You could get a time advance like this.
So what I really want is an asymptotic time advance. So you send something in from infinity, you wait till it gets out at the other side of infinity, and you race it against some particle that's not interacting at all, and it wins that race.
That's a little harder, but probably, my money would be on yes, that's possible.
Okay, I'd take that bet.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all been recorded, so.
Yeah.
Wonderful. If there's no other questions, then let's thank Kerr again.